Good morning to both the council and our other observers. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Thank you very much for your flexibility this morning in converting this from an in-person calendar to a Zoom calendar. We would much rather see you in person, but unfortunately, the circumstances did not allow that this morning. I am joined this morning by my colleagues, Judges Borky and Jessen, and we are now ready to hear the argument in the second case on our calendar this morning. That case is in the matter of the welfare of the child of PDJ parent, case A220501. Both counsel are present. Counsel, I'll just provide you with a few argument notes before we hear from you. The appellant will have 15 minutes this morning to present an argument. Respondent will also have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes to present a rebuttal. The clock on the screen will be keeping track of our time. Can you both see that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Finally, we are making an audio recording of the argument that will be available on the court's website shortly. And to make sure that the quality of that recording is good, I ask that you please keep your Zoom in mute when you are not presenting your argument. With that, we are ready to begin. We will first hear from counsel for the appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Creston Gackle. I represent the appellant mother, PDJ, in this matter. This case is about whether the most severe outcome possible in a civil court, an expedited termination of a mother's parental rights to an infant child, can be sustained by a trial record devoid of expert or personal knowledge of egregious harm. The essential issue here is that no substantive evidence of egregious harm was admitted, properly admitted, or properly weighed at trial. At its core, this is a sufficiency of the evidence case. It was an abuse of the district court's discretion to find clear and convincing evidence of egregious harm when there was no such evidence admitted at trial. Specifically, Exhibits 22 and 23, the medical reports, were not admitted by the district court. That's clear from the transcript. The agency did not ensure that its most critical exhibits were admitted to actually provide proof of either physical injury or actual proof that the injury was caused by or known to PDJ. It is absolutely an abuse of discretion to find that the high bar of clear and convincing evidence, the bar we set before a district court may even consider granting the government's request to irreparably sever the natural relationship between a mother and child.
Counsel, right at the beginning of your argument here, I would like to clarify what you are arguing and what you're not arguing. It sounds like you're challenging the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, but at pages 25 and 26 of your brief, and even during some of your remarks this morning, you also seem to be arguing that the district court erroneously admitted evidence in this case, such as the police report. And I just want to be clear whether you are, making a supplemental evidence error argument or whether this is truly a sufficiency case, at least, from your perspective.
Thank you, Your Honor. The brief and what I'm arguing today essentially is that given the dearth or the lack of evidence admitted at trial, there is not substantive evidence upon which the court could rely to find clear and convincing evidence that egregious harm occurred or that PDJ knew about it or caused it.
Mr. Gackle, the trial court did hear from testimony of the social worker that the child nearly died because of alcohol in its system. And the court also heard that separate and apart from that, there was chemical injury burns which is direct testimony. The foster mother testified there are still marks on her body. Where is that lacking in sufficiency? It seems to me that the additional evidence that you felt they needed to present would have been cumulative. Why would it have been something more? Why was that not enough, having laypersons testify or individuals that were familiar with the child?
Thank you, Your Honor. Absolutely, I would disagree with that sentiment. Essentially, Your Honor, there was statements made by the ongoing social worker and the foster parent, neither of whom had any personal, direct, or expert knowledge as to the actual alleged incident that brought this into court. The agency chose not to call its own child protection investigator that was on the case prior to the ongoing social worker. It chose not to call any police officers or medical experts. Essentially, what you have is that the foster parent believes that there are marks on the child's back and that the social worker may have read a report that she later relied upon. What you don't have, and what the district court didn't have, is any foundational reliability to the fact that the essential facts that have to be proven by clear and convincing evidence at an egregious harm trial. Number one, that actual physical injury occurred. And number two, that the physical injury was caused to or known by PDJ. You don't have what you have in, frankly, the entirety of the case law that I could find from the Court of Appeals, a doctor or a surgeon or somebody else that has actual knowledge of writing these reports, allegedly, that says, I'm qualified, I have the knowledge to say whether this was accidental or naturally occurring or not, and this is my medical opinion about whether it was caused by PDJ doing something wrong or causing some abuse to the child. You simply don't have that here, and it is an abuse of discretion to view the testimony of these two witnesses as sufficient to terminate PDJ's rights. I will say it is in some ways confusing, and I apologize for it not being totally clear in the initial brief. But the issue is essentially 22 and 23, the medical report, the alleged medical reports written by alleged medical experts who never testified at trial, they weren't admitted by the district court. District court never said they were admitted. The police report and the attached variety of photos, 18 and 19 was admitted for the
Let's go back to exhibits 22 and 23, the medical reports. You're saying that there wasn't enough evidence because they weren't admitted. It seems to be a circular argument because you could have submitted them. I don't think it would have helped your case. And that's the reason I'm asking what outcome. It seems like you're protesting something that was rather in your client's favor than not. Did you make any offer of proof that there was any testimony or any content of that document that would have relieved your client of claims that that the child had suffered egregious harm?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I will just clarify just for a brief moment that I was not counsel at the trial court level. What I will say is that it's not PDJ's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that she caused egregious harm. It's not even her burden to prove that it didn't happen. It's the agency's burden.
I understand that. It's the agency's burden, but the agency did present testimony. Your complaint to us on our review on appeal is that the medical records weren't submitted, but I'm asking you, how would those medical records have helped your client's case? How would they have disproven the testimony of the social worker?
I'm not totally on the same idea as the question, I believe, Your Honor. I think the answer to your question is that I don't know whether it would have helped or hurt PDJ, because I don't know that the content of those reports, under the pressure of cross-examination and review of the people who purportedly wrote the report, and the evaluation of their qualifications, the follow-up with their duties, the contemporaneousness. I don't know, frankly, whether it would have helped or hurt PDJ. All I can say is
I understand, I'll not belabor that point. Thank you for your answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just will say that there...
So if I can follow up on Judge Warkey's area of questioning, though. And I understand you're saying that your point is that there were two exhibits, the medical records, that weren't in evidence, but was there an objection to the social worker testified that the child died almost died last summer as a result of the alcohol in her system or something close to that. Was there an objection to that testimony as being without foundation? Or is, you know, being inappropriate, you're saying that weren't an expert. Was there objection saying she's an inappropriate witness?
An objection was not made as to that issue. I think I would point to the lengthy discussion between the district court and the prosecutor following an objection to exhibits 22 and 23, as well as to 18 and 19, about trying to admit essentially a ton of report and purportedly expert evidence without having any foundational reliability given by witnesses with actual knowledge of that evidence. I mean, what you really...
I'm just trying to understand why it would be inappropriate for us to rely when we're looking at for clear and convincing evidence on the social workers and I assume the guardian's testimony in this regard if they weren't objected to.
Sure. I mean, essentially, Your Honor, in an egregious harm case, it's a particularly special kind of case, especially with, you know, relief from reasonable efforts, no duty to reunify, expedited timelines, and termination of being the highest level kind of civil penalty that can be inflicted. I mean, what we're looking at is essentially two lay witnesses who have secondhand knowledge, if any, and we don't know the actual bases of that knowledge. Now, I can understand the court's, you know, wanting to understand the district court's decision making here, but the district court, I mean, really didn't have enough to find egregious harm by clear and convincing evidence. When you look at all the prior cases involving egregious harm, you have doctors, radiologists, surgeons, people that say this bone broke and it was non-accidental, and the parent or parents were in control of the child.
Exactly. If I may, then let's move beyond. If you're saying, okay, egregious harm, that is a really high standard. We usually have doctors, but what about, why wouldn't this evidence as testimony from the social worker that I just referred to, and as well as the guardian's testimony, be enough to support, you know, to show clear and convincing evidence for palpable unfitness or not complying with parental duties? Because we only need one statutory ground here. Could you address that for me?
I understand, Your Honor, and I think that's acknowledged in the brief that if the agency were to prevail on any of the statutory grounds, then that would be enough for the court to uphold the district court's decision. However, I think what is argued throughout the initial brief and what I would argue today is that essentially the vast majority, if not the entirety of the district court's opinion, relies on evidence that was either not admitted, not properly admitted, or shouldn't have been considered because it wasn't given any foundational reliability. We don't have foundational reliability to medical reports or police reports because we didn't have the police officers and the medical experts who purportedly wrote those reports available to testify. The agency should have, if it thought that it was a simple case, should have called those witnesses simply to provide the basis for those opinions, the fact that they actually wrote those reports. We don't know, frankly, from this record.
This kind of gets back to my initial question, though, because, you know, given your use of the term foundational reliability and your, you know, concerns about the evidence that was admitted, I mean, it sounds like you're making evidentiary arguments as opposed to a sufficiency argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I think I'm saying, and I apologize if it's not clear, is that the overall record does not provide substantial evidence to support the findings of fact or conclusions that the district court made that PDJ caused egregious harm to the child, or even frankly, that egregious harm even occurred. I will just add that in addition, what we're talking about as well is that these other grounds that are mentioned are really largely based on this allegation of egregious harm that was never proved. For the compliance with parental duties, you need reasonable efforts. The court found that reasonable efforts were offered. That was a totally baseless finding. There was no case plan that was jointly created nor court ordered. It was simply a voluntary case plan from a checkmarked EPC initial order with no detail and no relation to anything. They never let PDJ see her own child during the course of the case. There was never an opportunity to demonstrate parenting skills or safety. Again, this is an egregious harm case. The agency acknowledged in its notes and at trial had no obligation to provide reasonable efforts and chose not to. And there's really no pattern here. There's no pattern demonstrated except that they think that, you know, that the egregious harm incident alleged is somehow going to occur again.
So, Mr. Cackle, if I may, because I initially, when I look at some of these facts, was concerned about her not seeing the child when looking at reasonable efforts. But then as I looked further, it appeared to me, and I'd like to get your take, your reaction on this, knowing the record better than I do, you know, that your client hadn't provided the UAs or, you know, gone through the treatment that had been called for in, you know, your, you know, at least the list of things that the county was offering her, whether you call that a case plan or not. Could you address that for me?
Certainly. I would argue, based on this record, that the efforts were not at all reasonable. They were not timely, accessible, or appropriate. Again, there was no case plan, no jointly created case plan. Case plan has no relation to the far more detailed and tailored case plans developed in the course of normal CHIPS cases. The extent of the efforts in this case, as far as I could tell from the exhibits presented, was, and including the SSIS notes, was basically the ongoing social worker saying that she had tried to contact PDJ, and PDJ attempting to provide records to that ongoing social worker that the social worker found inadequate for her purposes. It was no attempt to orchestrate, for example, a supervised visit. There was no effort essentially, Your Honor, there just seemed to be this a cataclysm of just, you know, just a lack of relationship that the social worker and that PDJ developed. And again, the social worker didn't have a duty to develop that relationship. There was no case plan for PDJ to follow. I mean, this is an egregious harm case. If the agency and the district court had actually followed the timelines, this should have come to a trial much sooner rather than later. And the decision should have been based on the allegations of egregious harm, not based on, you know, frankly, inadequate efforts to reunify. You know, PDJ deeply cares.
I'll just note, in case you haven't noticed that your time is up, if you
could
just please conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. PDJ is requesting that this case be reversed and remanded. The agency may have an opportunity to file a new petition if it chooses, but this record, frankly, is devoid of any substantial evidence to support the district court's findings and conclusions of law. Is clearly erroneous as to the evidentiary rulings on 18, as to 18, and we would ask for a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we will hear from counsel for respondent. You have 15 minutes and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department. First, I apologize for the lighting. I'm in a room that I don't normally do hearings from. The department does contend, as I think is briefed, that the record as a whole does support a termination of parental rights on all three statutory bases. To the extent that the court needs to reach appellant's evidentiary issues, I would note that the department does, we do contest that the court did not admit exhibits 22 and 23, the medical, which are both medical reports. There was a colloquy on the record in response to appellant's trial counsel's objection. And the court said something to the effect of, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but we'll see how it develops. The trial court did express some reservations, but did not specifically say that the evidence was not going to come in, did not make its final ruling. So I think it's not accurate to say, as appellant argues on the evidentiary issue, that exhibits 22 and 23 were not admitted. I believe that they were listed as admitted into the in the trial court's final termination of parental rights order. And at the most, the issue at trial was ambiguous.
I want to clarify that.
Thank you.
So there's nothing in the transcript at trial that says that exhibits 22 and 23 were admitted, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Because I mean, can we just stop there? Because this is a concern to me. I mean, to me, I see this as more than just an evidentiary issue, just speaking for myself, not for the panel. But, you know, we're supposed to look for clear and convincing evidence to support a grounds for termination. And so I do think it's a fundamental question when you're talking about egregious harm, you know, can there be clear and convincing evidence where they're not medical records if the medical records were not, assuming just for a moment that they were not admitted? I mean, that is my, I'd just like you to address that concern of mine, Ms. Lynch.
I think there can be. I think that that would be tough on this particular record. In the abstract, I think that medical records are not statutorily or otherwise required. I think egregious harm can be met in other ways. I do agree that this child's medical status was part of the egregious harm analysis. So I think it is difficult if those reports did not come in at all. I will note that the medical situation was also discussed in the police report. I understand that appellant's counsel objects to that. Those reports were clearly admitted. I do also note that the SSIS notes, which are the case notes, in exhibits 16 and 17 were admitted without objection, and 16 was the investigation, and there is discussion of the medical evidence in there as well. So in addition to the social worker's statements about the social worker who testified, there's corroborating information, particularly from the foster parent about the injuries, the degree to which the injuries did affect the child. In addition, I think, you know, egregious harm, although it does focus typically on injuries, also looks at the context of parenting. The standard is whether it's such that a reasonable person would conclude that that parent cannot parent that child or any child. And the context of the parenting at the time of the July 2021 opening was established through other evidence, specifically appellant's mental health issues, the conditions and activities in her home, her own use, her, you know, inability or failure to attend to her mental health issues, and her ongoing chemical health problems. So and that was directly linked to parenting, both in the specific incident, but also in other evidence. There was direct testimony about a witness who saw appellant have a escalating domestic incident in which she, used bleach, not the chemical at issue in our particular case, and the harm of the baby, but ended up using bleach that she splashed onto other people, including one of her other children. So the overall context that's created by the evidence before the court does provide sufficient context for the trial court to have made those findings regarding egregious harm. I do agree that, concede if need be, that there would have been greater weight if there had been an expert testifying in support. But it is clear, as established on the record, that the fact of that report coming in was known or being offered is known. The agency briefed the fact that it was going to be offering records through business records and other routes. And so I think that the evidence was properly admitted. In addition to those medical reports, again, I would say that the medical issues were before the trial court in other ways, in addition to the actual reports.
I'll just note, it does also seem piling on to Judge Jessen's question, it does seem sort of unusual to me that, you know, in this case where the district court expressed pretty grave concerns about the quality of the evidence. And by quality, I mean, you know, the fact that this was essentially a paper trial. Most of the actual facts were submitted in police reports and other documents. And it seems strange given that the district court said during the trial, you know, you got to have a witness. What is this? That concern was never really directly addressed. And the district court made its findings based largely on the documents that were submitted, in particular the police reports. And I'm just wondering how we should evaluate that part of the trial. And, does that affect our consideration of the weight of the evidence and whether this county satisfied its burden here?
I would say that there were sort of two different categories. Your Honor, you referred to two different categories of evidence. I do agree that there is some ambiguity in the record regarding the medical reports because of the judge saying, normally I would expect to see an expert. Other evidence did come in after that. The police documents are a separate category. The court, there were two layers of objections. The court admitted those records. So I would say that it's different as to weight and the issues are different. To the extent that, I don't think the court's termination of parental rights order actually credited the medical reports as an expert finding that it relied upon. It didn't rely upon the facts in those reports. I think that's different than the police report, which was a document of that investigation, as well as the incident that happened that night in July of 2021. So those are two different categories. I would say the court I do not think the record is ambiguous. I don't think there was any error in admitting the police reports. And again, much of that same evidence is covered in the agency's notes regarding the investigation, which was in one of the exhibits admitted without objection. I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor.
If I could transition for a moment, perhaps some of these questions were what led me, as demonstrated by my questions to appellant's counsel, to really look at the other statutory grounds, which then does bring us back to was there a case plan? Which Mr. Crackle says, well, there's not. There was just kind of a list. So would you just give me your best answer to Ms. Lynch? Was there a case plan? Where do we look to see that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say there was a case plan. There was a testimony from the social worker. There is discussed in Exhibit 17, which is one of the exhibits that was submitted without objection. There's description as well as referred to, I believe, briefly in the transcript by the child protection worker, that there was an early meeting regarding services, regarding the situation in the family that involved appellant, agency workers, as well as other support folks. The social worker testified to providing the case plan, what was described as the case plan, sending copies of it by email. And the social worker, describing repeated attempts to connect with appellant, would talk about providing those services. The agency did provide, there is direct testimony about the agency providing referrals for the mental health evaluations, for parenting evaluation, for the chemical health, the agency's attempts to get the chemical health results, testing results, UAs. I think very importantly, there was the agency is required by statute. It's not actually part of litigation. I would contest with the agency, with appellant's characterization of the pre-hearing reports. The agency, through pre-hearing reports and then through the oversight hearings, that the activities that happened during the three or four hearings between the EPC hearing and the trial, the agency was reporting on those activities. There was discussion, there's court orders about the court continuing to ask for the psychological evaluation as part of deciding whether or not to do visits. At one point, appellant asks to be able to provide chemical health reports via using the sweat patch process, rather than UAs. The agency had asked for UAs. The court granted that request for the sweat patch. So although the agency was relieved of reasonable efforts, there was not a statutory case plan as part of the compliance factors. There was a case plan in the sense of the agency clearly indicated what it would want to see before the from appellant and elsewhere. Because there was a relative search that is part of reasonable efforts as well. The agency clearly communicated what the agency wanted to see happen. That was linked to the concerns that led to that home placement of this child. And the agency was within court oversight. And there was an active engagement in court, at least, about what that case plan should be. So I would say, yes, there was a case plan to the extent relevant for those other two statutory grounds, failure of parental duties and palpable unfitness. If we were talking about a failure to correct conditions requiring placement, that would be a different situation. Then we would need to have a fully compliant, statutorily compliant case plan, sometimes referred to as the SSIS case plan. But substantively, it is our position that the same things happened. And therefore, the courts, sort of a multi-part analysis, right? The courts findings regarding reasonable efforts were not in clear error. They were not an error of law. They were not an error of fact. And that activities, the information presented by the agency at trial is relevant to those other two statutory bases. I think particularly failure of parental duties, because there is, as I believe we referenced in our brief, the progress of a parent during a case opening in court is relevant to that failure of parental duties ground. It can be as well to appellate one fitness, but it's clear as to failure of parental duties because part of what's going on there is figuring out what was presented in the petition of failure of parental duties, and also is the parent continuing to have the same situation. So I would say that, yes, there was a case plan for the purposes of the statutory grounds of the right issue. And also, I think it goes to the integrity of the trial court's findings that it was appropriate for the trial court to look at that in the findings without clear error. I would just further note that I think it's implicit in some of the questions here, that the department does believe, as argued in our brief, that appellant needs to establish prejudice. If we're talking about evidentiary issues, we do not believe that is there. We do believe that the evidence as a whole supports the trial court's findings and termination of parental rights. The department provided a sufficient and clear guide for appellant to meet the concerns that led to out-of-home placement, that led the trial court to order out-of-home placement. And with that benefit of oversight, the department does believe that, those reasonable efforts are supported, as well as the sufficiency of the evidence. The department does think that sufficiency of the evidence is at issue here. I would note that the court, as I believe, actually, I think all of you, both Judge Jessen and Judge Gaia said the department, this court need look at one statutory ground. I think that although we do think that egregious harm is met, we do think that both the failure of parental duties and palpable unfitness are also sufficiently sustained in the record. We would ask the court to affirm.
So, Ms. Lynch, if I may.
Yes.
Appellant's counsel also addressed an issue about the trial date and the timeliness of these court proceedings. You're more familiar with the record than I am. Was there ever an objection made? Any discussion about the timeliness of this before the lower court? And perhaps this also fits into your prejudice argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that there was no prejudice established. There was no objection. Indeed, appellant's whole argument was to get more time to work on a case plan, presumably. There was a specific discussion, either the December or January hearings, I can't remember which, where the agency's counsel specifically said the agency's counsel was going to wanted to go forward with trial prior to resolution of the connected criminal case. And the department said that they were going to do that. And at that point, the appellant did not object and indeed said that they did not ask for trial to happen immediately. Indeed, said that they would prefer to continue it until after the criminal trial. I will note that the department did not call appellant at the trial in this matter, department did carefully attend to the issues involved in this case. They are complicated cases when it overlaps with the criminal case. And with the record as a whole indicates that the trial court took this trial very seriously, gave appellant a chance to present a full case. Appellant's argument was to have more time, and so that I think that speaks specifically to the issue of the timing of the trial. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Ms. Lynch. And now we will go back to counsel for appellant. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to bring to the forefront that we're looking right now at 14 months or about 424 days of separation between an infant and her mother in what was supposed to be an expedited egregious harm case. The timelines were not followed. I will just note that the agency mentions some kind of incident with the bleach, which occurred 4 months before the alleged egregious harm incident and before this particular child was born. The agency also mentions mental health issues, chemical use. Frankly, Your Honors, that's within the purview potentially of a CHIPS case. That's not an egregious harm. It's not proof of egregious harm. That's not clear and convincing evidence to terminate based on a pattern of failure to comply with parental duties or palpable unfitness. You really, at the end of the day, this record does not contain clear and convincing evidence of egregious harm or that PDJ caused or knew about it. And you have, frankly, during the period that this case was open, mere inconsistency with a non-jointly created, non-court-ordered case plan. That's not enough to terminate without actual reunification efforts. On appeal from a district court's order terminating parental rights, this court can review underlying facts of findings of fact for clear error, determination of whether a statutory ground actually exists, and ultimate decision of whether it's an abuse of discretion, even if there's no post-trial motion filed. And, you know, the evidentiary issues we can go back and forth on. Exhibit 18 was admitted as a public record. That was a clear error without foundational reliability. We cite Simon and Barnes for that. And the district court itself pointed out that issue. There's no foundation for those records. There's no foundation for qualifications, duties, processes of the people that allegedly wrote those things. Frankly, those are pieces of paper that just, we don't know somebody off the street wrote them. Exhibit 19, I will just correct, it was not admitted for its substance. It was admitted for its impact on the child protection investigator who didn't testify. And I'll remind the court that these are undated, unmarked, unknown time, place, photographer, addenda to Exhibit 18. Exhibit 18, as I've already discussed. Your Honors, finally, on the due process issue, I would just say that, again, these kinds of delays, you can argue that it benefits or doesn't benefit PDJ, but at the end of the day, she's been separated from her infant child for well over a year. I mean, that's in itself to me is prejudice.
Trial counsel didn't object. I don't know if this is necessarily before us.
Understood, Your Honor. My understanding of Teal v. Stitch, and as noted in the brief, is that while it's not objected to, it's only a general rule, not a be-all, end-all, absolutist jurisdictional rule. I understand if the court interprets it differently, but frankly, Your Honors, this kind of delay, this kind of, you know, messing around with possibly reasonable efforts, possibly not reasonable in an egregious harm case, that's just going to continue. We're going to continue to have a violation of the timelines. And that, you know, that's not PDJ's fault, and that's not PDJ's burden to ensure that those are necessarily followed under the advice of her own counsel. I will just conclude, Your Honors, this case is really, I mean, there's barely enough evidence in here, if any, for a default. There's barely enough evidence in here for proving some kind of neglect occurred. You have no personal or expert knowledge of the primary incident that the agency was so convinced occurred, and yet the agency chose not to call such critical witnesses to provide basic outline of foundation and personal knowledge and contemporaneousness for exhibits that they were trying to get in. And the district court recognized that and yet still signed off on the order that it issued. We are asking this court to reverse, remand for further proceedings. The agency may have time to file a new petition if it deems it necessary, but there simply is not evidence to sustain the district court's findings of egregious harm, or that PDJ caused that egregious harm, or that PDJ's parental rights should be terminated for any other reason by clear and convincing evidence. If the Your Honors have no further questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you both for your very helpful arguments.